Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, sent up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, 60 million people, 60 million acres. That's Britain. But where's my acre? We speak to Robin Gray, who's been performing a play, 3 Acres and a Cow. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. But we start this week with Robin Gray, who's doing a play now. What is it? Did I get it right? Is it 3 Acres and a Cow, Robin?
Yes, 3 Acres and a Cow. The full title is 3 Acres and a Cow, A History of Land Rights and Protest in Folk Song and Story.
So what is the significance of this term, 3 Acres and a Cow?
3 Acres and a Cow was a slogan of the land reform movement in the late 1800s. At that point in history, you know, people had been cleared off the land during the Industrial Revolution and the parliamentary enclosures within living memory. And they, you know, really hoped that they'd be able to repopulate the countryside and move out of the cities and towns. And 3 acres and a cow was the amount that was decided, that was sort of, you know, an amount that a family could quite happily be self-sufficient on at that period in history.
So why didn't they just want to carry on working in the factories?
I think that the long hours, the conditions, the lack of seasonality, and you know how controlling they found it meant that it was quite highly undesirable for the vast majority of people, not to mention the fact that the living conditions in towns and cities at that time was, you know, kind of what we would think of now as some of the worst slums and shanty towns in the third world.
That's right. I mean, it's a bit like what's happened in China more recently. A lot of people moving out from the countryside, from a very simple existence, into factories and things in the city, then suddenly finding that economic conditions aren't so good, they're not being paid so much, and starting to think about actually returning back to the countryside. Also, it's William Blake's Jerusalem hymn, isn't it, where he talks about the dark satanic mills. So I wonder,
absolutely,
if they were looking back towards the countryside, was there any success there? I mean, people had already been moved out of the countryside, but they're looking at returning there.
Yeah, I mean, there were some successes. I think many more in Ireland as a result of the Irish Land League, and, you know, they had a bit more of an extreme situation, and obviously, you know, the horrendous famine that they had, and so they were a little bit more motivated and bold with their agitation than was realised by English, Scottish and Welsh brethren.
So tell us about the play, 3 Acres and a Cow. Do you bring a cow on stage?
No, we don't, and I don't tend to call it a play. I tend to keep it more as a show or performance. I mean, it really aims to be like a cross between a TED talk, a folk club sing-along, a fireside storytelling session and a poetry slam. It really, and wherever I go in the country with the show, we always try and get local performers to come and bring their local stories and songs to the show. So it changes, you know, most times, and it's been evolving over the course of the last 2 or 3 years as a lot of the information and detail in the show is sort of crowdsourced off people who've seen the show.
So how do you, if you're starting off a show, you're saying you haven't actually got a script that you're working from?
We don't have a script, no. I've had to jot down a few thoughts now because I've actually just finished a project to develop a performer's kit so that I can take on apprentices and train other people up to be able to do the show. And that's meaning I am starting to have to script some elements of it just so other people can learn it, because obviously they don't have 3 years to sit and read books and research it in quite the depth that I've gone. But, you know, most of the time there's I'm kind of just reacting to the things I've read recently and sort of drawing a narrative through 1,000 years of history and making people realize that history isn't just memorizing dates and knowing what the kings and queens were up to. Actually, you can, you know, really connect and resonate with what people were up to over that 1,000 years.
But I mean, you know, we're living a very fast-paced existence, modern laptops, a lot of people with a high-stress lifestyle, working all the hours God sends in the cities, overcrowded. I mean, how relevant is what you're saying for today? I'd imagine quite a lot of people would be looking at it and thinking, well, this is a million miles away from the modern world.
Yeah, no, those are good questions. I mean, I think one of the things, there's a few really strong messages that we try and get across at the end. One of the things is, you know, if you're campaigning for something or you're trying to fight for your rights, if you look at history, it's really important to realize that, you know, you might not get to see the fruits of that battle in your lifetime. You know, you never know when the seeds that you plant are going to bear fruit. So, you know, I think there's a lot of hope in that, because a lot of the time people just have this sort of Hollywood heroes narrative where one person comes along, fights against all odds, everybody starts following them, and they save the day and ride off into the sunset on horseback. And so it's just starting to tell people some different stories and narratives and times when, you know, we have won rights and we have won battles, and times when they've been lost as well, and just what, you know, what that looks like from a much more sort of real and historical perspective.
Now, in the modern world, I mean, we here in Bristol, we've got Cabot Circus, which used to be public land, public property, public streets, policed by ordinary police. Now it's private police. It's all been privatised, and it's a giant private shopping centre. That's a good example of privatisation of our streets and of our land.
Absolutely. I mean, enclosure is definitely still happening. It's just moved into the towns and cities, and also into intellectual property such as seeds and things. You know, they're trying to, you know, copyright and enclose, you know, DNA in the genome and seeds and stuff. So, you know, just understanding the historical processes of land enclosure can really connect up and be very, very relevant to a lot of the battles that are being fought today.
Okay, well, take us back a few hundred years, maybe before the English Civil War. How was land managed out in the countryside before it was enclosed or privatised?
So the form of land ownership at that time was much more cooperatively managed. The land was called the commons, and the idea was that everybody had rights to be able to grow food and forage for wood and keep some animals on that common land. And this was kind of left over from Anglo-Saxon models of land ownership. When William the Conqueror sort of achieved the land grab of all land grabs, he, in order to appease the peasants, left their sort of cooperative model of land ownership intact, despite the fact that he, you know, essentially took ownership of the land away from those people in ultimate terms.
Yeah, I mean, he was 1066, wasn't it, William the Conqueror? But the previous system was called, I know, the open field system. In villages were really not so much called villages, they were called manors, and they had a lord of the manor that seemed to rule the village, and, you know, that was the kind of part of the feudal system. But practically day to day, how was it different to the way the countryside is managed now?
Well, everybody worked on the land. I mean, it wasn't until, you know, the late 1700s that, you know, the vast majority of people lived in cities and towns. So, you know, everybody essentially was a sort of small-scale family farmer, and you worked on your land and worked your crops certain days of the week, and then you had feudal obligations to work for the lord of the manor on certain days of the week or at certain times of the year, you know, a lot more or a lot less depending on the season. And you know, you were technically a serf, which meant that you were private property of the lord of the manor, so you needed to get his permission to marry, and there were various other sort of, you know, things that you know, because you were technically owned by this lord, you had to get their permission to be able to do.
Now, there's a book came out, I think it was in the 1960s, called The Tragedy of the Commons, which painted Garrett Hardin was the author, and it painted this picture of, well, it was kind of inevitable that there was going to be mismanagement of the open fields and that there were going to be squabbles and it wasn't really going to work. Do you buy that?
Yeah, no, well, The Tragedy of the Commons basically has been completely disowned by its author and completely ripped apart by the scientific community, and quite how it got published in the scientific journal is something that slightly baffles a lot of people, because it's a very, very flawed piece of work. And as I said, the author who wrote it himself is horrendously embarrassed by it, and a lot of the monstrous things that it's been used to justify by sort of neoliberal you know, politicians, bankers and policymakers. So, you know, I mean, I think even the person who wrote it would be quite happy to rip it up, burn it, or use it to wipe his bum nowadays.
Well, so, you know, basically it wasn't a tragedy, so it wasn't inevitable. What was the process by which, I mean, because many of our ancestors would have been working in these open fields, would have had a, you know, a much more agrarian style existence. Now we've got this kind of industrial agriculture with some guy in an office in somewhere in a city clicking a mouse and sending in the, you know, the harvest machines or the or planters, or you know, this kind of thing, or harrows into the fields from a distant place. I mean, we've kind of lost that, haven't we? So ultimately, how was it that we came? You know, you can't just persuade people to say, "Well, hang on a minute, guys, you're going to have to just leave your land and forget about it."
Oh no, I mean, it was done, you know, very violently. I mean, we, you know, the Highland Clearance is much more within living memory, and the brutality that was with which the Scots were treated in the way they were cleared off their land is still something that, you know, the Scottish national conscience really holds on to today. But I think we've just quite simply had our history erased, and in the Tudor times, and even slightly before, you know, literally hundreds of people were cleared off their land in often a day or so, and you know, was sort of became a migrant vagrant underclass without land and without any rights. And it's just something that's been, you know, pretty boldly wiped out of our consciousness. And one of the fun things about being a folk singer has been going back and excavating some of that, and you'll be pleased to know that I've been anonymously sent some ballads from, you know, the 15 and 1600s that have never seen the light of day, that, you know, are sort of primary source material and proof of people's resistance to this process of people being cleared off the land.
Well, one of the things that really accelerated the enclosures, the privatisation of our land, was the English Civil War. And that's, again, that's another thing that many of us probably, you know, it'd be difficult to place where it happened historically, which century it happened, the English Civil War, let alone how it affected the acceleration of privatisation of land. So what are your thoughts about the English Civil War and how that fits into how we lost, I suppose, our land rights, the rights to stay on the land?
No, certainly. I think... From the readings that I've had, I think that a considerable amount more land and more damage was done before the English Civil War than people realised, but the English Civil War definitely was the nail in the coffin. When the Spanish discovered, inverted commas, South America and used gunpowder in order to persuade the locals to give them all of their silver, that caused the first European-wide inflation, because suddenly huge amounts of precious metals was dropped into Europe. And that inflation meant that Henry VIII had a lot less money and power than he had previously. So that's really what the dissolution of the monasteries was. It was about Henry VIII trying to shore up his finances by taking all of the church's land and assets. And that was a good short-term boost for him, but he ultimately laid the seeds of defeat for outright monarchy, because he sold off the land to this new sort of capitalist, lawyer, merchant classes who then gained enough power over the next 100 years to directly challenge the monarchy and the Stuart monarchy, and that sparked the English Civil War. So, you know, when you look at that process through the prism of land, it suddenly makes a lot more sense. And the English Civil War has always been, you know, it's not taught even remotely properly. It's kind of spun as this sort of goodies parliament and the people versus the king. But a far more useful way to think about it is, you know, a 1% elite, royalist sort of cavaliers versus a 1% elite, you know, kind of merchant parliamentarians. And the idea that any of them genuinely reflected what the other 98% of the population felt is sort of more stuff of myth than anything else.
We had the levellers and the diggers, didn't we, in the English Civil War? The levellers, to begin with, were amongst the soldiery. I mean, actually, they were soldiers themselves, and they were saying, well, look, you know, if we're going to be fighting for something, we want an army that represents the views of the soldiers who are fighting in it, which was
absolutely
quite an interesting idea. And afterwards, the diggers, who called themselves the true levellers, and the diggers basically squatted land, which was common land, and said, well, this civil war isn't worth anything unless the people get their land back. So what are your thoughts about those two movements, the levellers and the diggers?
No, I mean, the whole English Civil War period is fascinating. One of the reasons why it's most fascinating is because the censorship of the printing press was lifted just before the Civil War. It's the first time that the underdogs, and that you really get a sense of what people were thinking, because so many pamphlets were able to be presented, and therefore you get a really good crystallized understanding of what the levellers and what the diggers felt. But I don't think what they're feeling came out of nothing. I think it existed for quite a long time, but because of the incredibly repressive atmosphere and the censorship that was abound and the lack of access to printing presses, you know, it's only around the time of the English Civil War that we actually start seeing radical literature that we can read and recognise today.
I mean, that some of the, I mean, I've had a look at some of these English Civil War pamphlets, some of them even the originals from the time, and you get a kind of amazing sense of excitement that some of these printing presses have been liberated. I actually felt it was a little bit like, you know, something like pirate radio was when that first arrived.
No, absolutely,
on the scene.
It was. It really was. Yeah, and no, it is, you know, amazing reading those voices. I mean, there's a Digger's Song from 1649, which is their song that they wrote. And I mean, you know, that's just staggering to think that we can get together and sing something that, you know, radicals and free-thinking people were singing in the mid-1600s.
Now, also, people have pointed to the English Civil War as being really the birth of internationally of capitalism, where you've got a whole country which is run on the capitalist system, really run by the merchants, by the bankers.
Absolutely.
And so I guess we've got a bit of a apology to make to the rest of the world.
Yeah, again, you know, the English Civil War has spun as this wonderful thing where suddenly the tyranny of the monarchy was overthrew and we had a lovely parliament. But yeah, it really was, you know, spawning the devil in many, many ways. And once that cat had been let out of the bag and then spread over to America, we were really going down a road that has led to some pretty horrific status quos recently.
One of the things I know, which you know, is anyone that's interested in this starts to get fascinated by, is the idea of land as private property. Because obviously, you know, we talk about it. If you're someone who works in property, you work in land, you work in buildings and houses, and yet that's not the same as property. Say your car or your phone. Can land actually be your private property?
Gosh, that's a big question. I'm not quite sure where I sit on that. I mean, in my heart, I would love to think that private property could be abolished. I think that from what I've got from studying revolutions, and not just about England, but revolutions all over the world, is that a lot of the time just trying to make lots of small incremental changes, if it's possible, is infinitely preferable to a massive, massive overthrow of an entire system and trying to, you know, break all those chains in one go. And I'd love to, you know, think that that can and would work, but there aren't many examples of revolutions where that has been successful. Maybe the Haitian revolution is perhaps a good example, but certainly when you look at the American Revolution and the French Revolution, and you know, I've been studying Roman history quite a bit recently, a lot of the time when there is a sudden, you know, just splitting of all of the chains, the counter-revolutionary forces that come into play as a result of that do lead to an enormous amount of chaos and misery for a lot of people for a very long time. So, you know, would I want to get rid of private property? Yes. Would I want to just wave, you know, would I want a revolution tomorrow that made that happen? I'd love it, but I'm not sure that I think, you know, if we can make incremental changes towards that, knowing that that's the goal, that's more healthy.
Now, you know, you said earlier, history is written by the winners, or words to that effect anyway. And I mean, there's another great quote from Winston Churchill, isn't there? History will be kind to me, I know, because I shall write it.
Yeah.
If those peasants who were removed from the land, kicked off the land, many of whom couldn't read or write, actually had their voice, what do you think they'd be saying to us today?
I think a really strong notion at that time was in the idea of a person's birthright. And I think that we all have a right to resources, and you know, you could take that in the form of land, but you know, it's got to the point now where there's a lot of demonizing people on benefits and welfare state. But actually, if you look back at where that all came out of, you know, part of people being cleared off their land and the parliamentary enclosures was this promise that basically, look, we're taking your land away from you, but the new wealth that's going to create for us as a society will mean that we will always be able to support you in your time of need. So, you know, you see in a lot of folk songs this lyric, you know, England must pay us what she owes. And the fact that that's been forgotten and now people get demonized because they fall on hard times and they need the support of the country, I think is really atrocious.
There's also the word dole, isn't there? I remember looking that up years ago in Oxford from an old version of the Encyclopedia Britannica from God, the 1500s or something, early 1600s, and it said that the dole originally was a part or portion, most commonly of a meadow, where several persons have shares. So there's this kind of understanding, I think, that as people are removed from the land, their connection with the land is severed, that they become dependent, don't they, on the money system. And, of course, the money system at the moment, we keep being told, is in crisis.
Absolutely. No, it's true. And I hope that, you know, we'll see this general election a major shake-up of the political system, and, you know, this will allow some much more meaningful and badly needed reforms to happen, certainly in terms of the way that voting is done, and also in terms of being able to recall MPs who, you know, turn out to be crooks.
You've also hit the headlines over the last few days, haven't you, actually, in the national press. How did you manage to do that?
I was trying to get away from London and find a bit of peace and quiet, and I ended up in a small sleepy town at exactly the same time as David Cameron, who was making his first public walkabout during the general election. And I did what any folk singer would do. I got out my instrument, I got out a ukulele I had with me, and just started singing a protest song at him. And it got filmed and was on ITV News, Channel 4 News, BBC Radio, and the video of it has had a third of a million hits in the last week.
Well done. And I think maybe the best thing for us to do is to seek that out and play it after this interview on the show. Just remind us how people can find your plays or your shows that you do, and so we can see if there's one happening round this way, and if not, maybe even travel out for the weekend one Saturday or Sunday and see it.
Perfect. So my name's Robin Gray, G-R-E-Y, and if you go to robingray.com, there's lots of information there. But if you specifically want to know about the show 3 Acres and a Cow, that's 3acresandacow.co.uk, or Google it and it will come up.
Okay, so what was the song you were singing?
It's got a rude word in it. Am I allowed rude words on this podcast?
You can bleep it if you wish.
Okay. The song was Blit off back to Eton, Blit off back to Eton, Blit off back to Eton with all your Eton chums. Dinner at a food bank, dinner at a food bank, dinner at a food bank for all your Tory chums. 'Cause you sell the NHS, you sell the NHS, you sell the NHS to all your Tory chums. Won't you blit off back to Eton, blit off back to Eton, blit off back to Eton with all your Tory chums. That kind of thing.
Well done, Robin Gray. Thanks ever so much for joining us on
That's okay.
On Dialect.
Have a lovely evening.
And good luck with your play.
Thank you.
Sorry,
much,
it's not
Tony.
A play. No. Good luck.
Show.
Good luck with your show.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks, Tony. Robin. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Well, in case you hadn't noticed, there's an election coming up. In fact, local elections and a general election. And one of the things that you will hear a lot of is the main parties. The Conservative, Labour, the Lib Dems, the Greens and the UK Independence Party. I mean, effectively, we've got now five main parties. But one of the different parties that we don't hear a lot about is the Independents. And I'm joined on the line now by Della Reynolds, who is standing as an Independent. Hi, Della, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, thank you very much. It's good to get some airtime as an independent.
You find it difficult?
Oh, hugely difficult. In fact, I've written a blog piece on my website called votecitizen.com, What's So Frightening About Democracy? Because I find that we're blocked at every turn. We try to go out into the street and give out leaflets, and we're told the first week we went out, we were moved on by the police, even though we were standing in a public street. The second week we went out, we were accosted by a member of the public for putting our notice boards up on a public sign. And the third week we went out, the guys from the shopping centre moved us on to tell us it was private land, and we couldn't hand out leaflets and approach people on private land.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
It's really very difficult to be able to reach out with your message.
We've just had Robin Gray on, who does a play about privatisation of land. And that's what's been happening, isn't it? I mean, that's been happening actually for centuries, as he pointed out. But anyway, now you have got a bit of airtime. What do you stand for as an independent? I suppose that's the main thing in people's minds.
Yes, the reason I'm standing as an independent is because under any other party umbrella, I couldn't give out my direct message, which is I'm standing on the platform of accountability and basically the lack of accountability.
Well, hang on, Della, because a lot of parties talk about that.
Yeah. Well, they might talk about it in certain aspects to do with the issues that they're promoting. But I'm talking about general accountability right the way through society and the fact that we can't hold anyone to account. And what that leaves us with is impunity.
Well, hang on a minute, because that's an election. That's the whole point of it. You know, we're holding them to account.
Well,
if we didn't like what they did, we're going to get rid of them.
Well, that's right. That's exactly why I decided to stand, because I've been campaigning on the subject of accountability already. I run a pressure group campaigning for reform of the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman, who obviously deals with complaints, and found that it really just acts as a gatekeeper and closes down everyone's complaints. So, of course, the election is the one time you can hold your MP to account. We're in a very safe seat here in Esher and Walton, so it looks like our MP is going to cruise through to another victory. Once he gets back in, there's no way to remove him or to hold him to account. He doesn't have a job description. He's self-employed. There's no recall.
But, I mean, that's so, the whole point of democracy, is once somebody gets in, then you can't get rid of them.
Exactly, that's right. So this is our one chance every 5 years to hold them to account.
So are you saying that there should be some sort of election every month or something?
Well, there should be ways to hold your MP to account. I mean, they should have a job description. So at the moment, an MP only has to give a maiden speech. They don't have to turn up again.
Well, the thing is, I mean, isn't that actually its own answer, really, to your own question there, in that if some MP does behave like that, they're not going to get re-elected?
Well, what's actually happening here when we go out on the street is we're meeting quite a lot of people, and the largest group of them are actually completely turned off politics and don't want to know. And the next largest group, because we're in a very safe seat, are Conservative voters. But when I ask them, are you voting for the party or the person, and I've got a donkey, and I say, you know, would you vote for a donkey? And they all laugh at me. And then I say, but are you voting for the party or the person? Oh, the party. You know, we've had a Conservative MP in this area since 1906 continuously. And there were a whole lot of people here who would go out and put their cross in that blue square, completely regardless to what their MP does or doesn't do.
What about if there was a square saying none of the above? How well do you think that would do?
Well, I think that would be very popular with all the disaffected people we've met in the street, because they say there's no point voting, it won't make any difference. And if they had a none of the above, then they could put a protest vote and that would be counted and recorded. I think it's a good idea, but they won't do it, will they?
Well, look, let's just wave a magic wand for a minute, Della. I'm going to make you Prime Minister for a five-year term. What would you do? What would your programme be?
If I was Prime Minister? All right, well, I'm standing as a citizen candidate on the idea of direct democracy. So I would make sure that proportion of all the MPs were citizen candidates. And the way it would work is that people would stand for a term of office, a bit like jury service. So, and they would be normal citizens who would be chosen or put themselves forward to stand. They would represent the constituents by doing direct polling on all the key issues. And they would provide a check and balance in the strong party system that presently exists.
Well, what do you mean by direct polling?
Well, in our area, we've got this issue of Heathrow Airport with the third runway. So when that issue comes out, all the information would be put out online or at the library. Everyone would have a unique code, and you'd be able to use that unique code once to vote yes or no, so that when I went into the division lobby, I would vote with the majority of the constituents.
And they would be able to see whether you'd done what they'd asked you to do. But it does sound to me a little bit, especially if you're having, you know, sort of varying terms, a bit like a sort of electing an MP, not just as one job, but as a kind of job share. Now, most people are going to balk at that, surely.
Well, it's a pretty radical idea, to be honest. The Green Party have been going 30 years and they've only just started to take off. So direct democracy, I think, will have to find its way in the mix. But it's a good place to start. The nearest they've got in the world is Switzerland. where what they actually have is they pass the laws and they put the laws forward, but if the population are not happy with the laws, they can ask for a referendum. And they get a referendum, and then they can say, yes, we agree with it, or we don't agree with it. And actually, they very rarely ask for a referendum, but knowing that they can seems to give them a higher level of satisfaction with their politicians, and of course keeps the politicians in check, because if the policy is too extreme, they know it will trigger a referendum.
Well, it all sounds very good, but if you actually go to visit Switzerland, you go to somewhere like Zurich, yeah, everyone sort of stares ahead of them. No one talks to each other. There's no atmosphere. It's a very boring country.
There could be a lot of reasons for that. I'm just telling you that is the nearest country in the world to having anything approaching direct democracy now. So my suggestion is slightly different to that, because you'd actually have MPs representing you in the House, which they don't have.
Okay, so this idea of direct democracy, which seems to be your main thing, your standing to do, how do listeners follow it if they're interested and find out a bit more about it?
Right, well, there's a lot on my website, which is votecitizen.com, and it's vote-citizen.com in order to get there. And I explain there what the notion of direct democracy is and how, obviously, your MP can be held to account through direct democracy. And also the things that I could do as an independent MP. So I could pursue a local cause. I would be a backbencher. I wouldn't be looking to further my career, so I wouldn't be spending time on other issues that weren't related to my local area. I could raise a private member's bill, ask a question in the House, backbench debate. There's a lot of things an independent MP can do on the same basis that any other party MP can do, because it's all done on a lottery basis.
And how many citizen candidates like you are there standing around the country?
Well, I'm the first to stand in the UK, here in Esham Walton. The idea would be, if it took off, the citizen candidates would network to give a support system, but they would never become a party. Because the whole idea of a party is that the party then dictates, you know, a handful of people at the top pass down the message through everybody underneath, and the MPs lose their own power and ability to meet their constituency needs. So we'd never become a party, but we'd become a support network.
Now, you know what it sounds like to me? You'd be coming together not to have meetings, but to have socials. I think it stands a very good chance of success, Stella.
Nothing wrong with that. The whole point of Parliament is debate, you know, parley, to talk and debate. It doesn't really matter how and where you do it. I mean, what we have at the moment is an MP who knows absolutely nothing about a parliamentary matter, can be sent a message, go to the lobby, vote yes. So he hasn't attended any of the debate, he hasn't read any of the notes, he's got absolutely no idea what he's voting for, but he turns up and gets counted, and then off he goes back to whatever he was doing before. And that's democracy. What we have now is not really representative democracy at all.
Okay, Della Reynolds is standing in Esham, is it?
Esham and Walton, yes.
At this general election, thanks ever so much for joining us on Dialect.
Right, thanks very much. Bye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined by Angela Bellassi now for a look at some of the stories in the news at the moment. Well, I mean, it's a little bit late, isn't it? Because it's probably last week's most of this stuff. But let's have a chat about it anyway. Hospitals have been missing targets for nurses. This is in the run-up to the general election. It's a bit naughty, since the NHS is one of the main things that the parties have been talking about.
That's right. It's been reported in the Western Daily Press that the hospitals are missing their targets and are failing to meet, in fact, their own targets for the numbers of registered nurse hours filled during the day. This is taken from analysis by the Health Service Journal, and it found that 194 out of 229 acute hospitals are not meeting their targets. Acute hospitals are described as those which provide short-term treatment for serious injury or illness.
And they're the sorts of places that are a lot more likely to have accident emergencies, that sort of thing. Now, this is very, really naughty, isn't it? Because this is why I think we pay our tax, to make sure that these hospitals are working there when we need them. The last thing we want is to turn up and find out, oh, I'm sorry, your appointment's been cancelled or the ward is full. We haven't got enough nurses to look after you.
Well, the Shadow Health Secretary Andy Burnham has described this as proof of a shortage of nurses in the Tory NHS. However, the problem is, would it be different under any other party?
Well, I seem to remember that Labour were one of the people that started the whole process of privatisation for the National Health Service, even though they're kind of trumpeting away that, that this is... I mean, there's actually a bit of dispute over that. I remember reading that actually part of the very first PFI schemes and privatisation of the health service schemes actually happened under the Major government, which was just before Tony Blair. I suppose that'd be about 1996. So although most of the privatisation style things, like the effectively a private hospital, I mean, Southmead Hospital is effectively a private hospital because it's all financed by private money, this PFI private finance initiative deal. So what's, do you think, the prospect for change for the nurses? Are we going to have enough nurses after the election?
Well, we have different promises from the different parties. So we have Labour, which is promising more nurses and doctors. I believe they've pledged £2.5 billion, and they said by 2020 they expect to increase the number of nurses to by 20,000. Then you have the Tories, which are calling for a seven-day NHS service, and then the Lib Dems, which are looking for easy access to GPs. But, of course, the question is finance. And we have the former NHS boss, David Nicholson, who said none of these will help what's basically a crumbling financial situation for the NHS.
Well, he's talked about a black hole in the National Health Service finances, hasn't he? And he's saying none of the political parties are really addressing it. Another aspect here is you've got a pledge by Labour saying that they will make sure that all NHS workers speak English and can write English before they get a job in the National Health Service. Now, that sounds almost obvious, doesn't it? If someone is dealing with somebody's healthcare, they can't speak English and they can't write English and they can't read English, one would wonder if they're actually fit to do the job.
To me, you think it would be an obvious calling for the job.
Well, I know, and actually, funnily enough, in Germany, I know I was chatting with some people from Germany the other day. They're saying the way they've dealt with a lot of the problems they've been having with economic migrants is they've simply said to anybody that arrives in Germany wanting a job, the first thing you've got to do is prove to us you can speak German, and you can't get benefits or anything like that in Germany unless you can prove that you can speak and write and understand German. So I don't understand quite why we can't do that here. At least it seems that the Labour Party are going somewhere towards doing that in the NHS, which is probably one of the most critical jobs anybody could do, is looking after us whether someone lives or dies.
I believe it's also the same in Denmark. They have the same criteria.
Okay, come on. Come on, England. Wake up. We do need to have people that can actually speak English. And I know another thing to mention is we're broadcasting from the Beacon Centre, and the Beacon Centre, up until 2010, was used as an adult learning centre to teach English language to people who couldn't speak English who'd come to this country from abroad, whether that be asylum seekers or migrants of any sort. If they wanted to learn English, they could come to the Beacon Centre and learn it. Okay, another story I know you've looked at this week is slaves right here in Somerset. The Western Daily Press has got some pretty hot stories and quite worrying ones too.
That's right. Eight men from Romania have been rescued and taken to a place of safety after a dawn raid by police investigating claims of modern slavery at a site near Trowbridge in Wiltshire. The operation took place in Sennington, and also three men have been arrested.
So do we know what kind of work these people were doing?
Well, it's understood that the three men arrested ran a business, and police have asked people who may be familiar with this business to contact them if they've had any work done on their home or driveway. And it actually goes under three different names: Newston Barrett Driveways, Dryscrape Limited, and Signature Driveways.
So it seems that they weren't paying these people properly.
It appears so, and also they were living in what we've described as shocking conditions.
The trouble is, of course, though, Angela, if you and I were homeless, we would have to go and find whatever accommodation we could. And if someone said to us, here's somewhere to live, but you do have to come and work for me for X amount, even if it's below the minimum wage, we might have to say yes.
Well, I suppose we don't understand under what pretenses they were brought in. So it's often with human trafficking, it's a case of force or deception. So they may have been lured in with a promise of, you know, a great wage or a new way of life. And then once they were there, they were trapped, or gets to the point where, you know, they can't get out financially either.
Well, what would you say, though, to people whose overheads are so much, paying the rent, electricity bills, maybe bill for the car or whatever, that they simply cannot afford to make ends meet? I mean, they're working, many people nowadays working very long hours, but at the end of the week, they end up with actually no, virtually no, or even negative amounts of cash in their pocket.
Well, I mean, that is a problem.
And it's a form of slavery, isn't it? You're stuck. You can't. What can you do?
That's true, but I imagine this is slightly different. I mean, it's not just financial slavery. I imagine they were, you know, tied to the place as well. I mean, stuck there. But at the same time, I mean, how do you get out of that? I imagine there's help, but it's a tricky one, and I don't have the answer.
I think, yeah, the word slavery, you know, what it actually means is, I mean, the thing is, of course, that the slaves over in the Caribbean, that the merchant venturers, I like to remind everyone, had shipped over there at great vast profits back in the 1600s and 1700s, they weren't actually chained up while they were working or whatever. They were allowed to walk around. It's just that they were stuck because there was nowhere they could go, and they were legally bound to do it. Now, this is similar for a lot of people. They feel that if they move out from their job that they're doing at the moment, if they don't get another one, they're going to be out of their homes. So there is an element of slavery, I think, going on, wage slavery still. Anyway, Angela Balassi, I've been a little bit over-opinionated there. What do you think about the lot? I mean, is there such a thing as wage slavery?
I believe there is, and I think you can get into a vicious cycle where you're living hand-to-mouth and then you can't quit your job, or you're not in a position maybe to look elsewhere. And I do think, sadly, there are some employers that are aware of that and take advantage. So I think it does exist in some industries, but there, I suppose, we still have some options with there's still, you know, some choice available.
But not yet here at BCFM.
No.
Because we're all volunteers. Anyway, Angela Balassi, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Back in the late 1990s, the Prophecy Club in the United States took a series of unique insights into prophecy. Not Old Testament style, but modern prophecy, with the focus on how the Bible could be speaking directly to us today. Gail Ripplinger is an American writer who covered some shocking ways in which Rupert Murdoch's version of the Bible, the translation which he owns, is called the New International Version, misses out entire phrases from the original Greek, deleting references from fasting and prayer, for example. And even whole sets of verses are gone, as they are from the New King James Version, which Gail believes has been altered. So here's Gail Ripplinger talking about what she found researching her book, New Age Bible Versions.
C.S. Lewis talked about something called the philological arm of hell. Philology means what do words mean within a culture? Okay, hell has a powerful meaning in this culture. It's so powerful, people use it to swear, okay? But it's so archaic, they're swearing with it, but they had to take it out of the Bibles because it's so archaic and put in a word that no one knows what it means, Hades. Okay. The New King James omits the word damned, damnation. Now, they're omitting God and they're omitting damned, simple words like that. Now, if you went to a nightclub, you'd probably hear both of those words, and so I don't think that they're archaic. Okay, they have omitted devils in the New King James Bible. Now, the New King James says that it's from the same Greek text as the King James Version, but my collation indicates 1,100 minimum places where it has gone away from the traditional Greek text. And not only that, they do not use the Ben-Hakim Rabbinic Bible in the Old Testament. And so I'm afraid the logo on the cover is very symptomatic of what's happening there. Now let's look at a little bit about why that logo's on the cover. Everyone knows about Constance Cumby's book, The Hidden Ages of the Rainbow. Many, many years ago, she put that symbol on her book and included it with New Age logos, okay? And she talked about it representing the false trinity. And we're going to look at what false trinity does that represent. I found a book called Mastering Witchcraft, and in that book, there's a poem. And it refers to something called the unholy trinity. Now, inside the New King James, when you look at this logo, it will say that this is a symbol for the trinity. Okay? But what trinity are they talking about? And we'll look and see what trinity they're talking about. They're talking about, I think, the unholy trinity of witchcraft. Okay? Now, what I think they are talking about specifically is something called the Royal Arch degree in Freemasonry. Okay, the Royal Arch, now listen for those words, we'll be talking about what Royal Arch means in a few minutes, is a degree in Freemasonry that I believe was revitalized around the turn of the century by Aleister Crowley, who was the arch Satanist. He called himself the Beast. Okay, but in that initiation, three gentlemen put their toes together and formed the triangle within that Mobius, and then one arm goes underneath the other arm so that if you looked in an aerial view, their arms would create that logo. Now, the pagans have always been doing this, okay? Found a book called The Pagan Book of Days, and we've got three people, witches, getting ready to do just about the same thing. And so this is, you know, it isn't just something that the Masons have been doing. It's been going on for a long time. Now, this is from an old Masonic book. In that old Masonic book, we have something called the 3x3. Okay, we have these three men putting their toes together. I think guys holding hands and putting their toes together isn't real good anyway. So, I mean, right away, as soon as they said do that, I'd say wrong. Okay, they put their toes together, forming that triangle inside there. Can you see that? And their arms, John Ankerberg did a video exposing the Masons. And the aerial view that he shows of this is the identical Mobius on the New King James. Now, he didn't know that, or he didn't catch that, or he'll probably cut it out of the video now that I've said it, but it is true, in fact. Now, this picture, it was part of the old Masonic book. In other words, this picture is, and I've got a blow-up of it, what you're looking at right here on the New King James. The only difference is they've got the rest of the serpent. But merely covering up the serpent, you can see that the overs and unders are identical. Now, why would they put this logo on the New King James? Why would James White's anti-King James book have this logo in it? Why would the Aquarian Conspiracy be using it? Why would the Trilateral Commission be using something nearly like this? This is Richardson's Monitor, which is one of those secret Mason books, you know. And it says, question, how shall I know you to be a royal archmason? By the 3x3. That's this. So by that logo, I will know that you're a royal archmason. Okay, now, this is an advertisement for CBN Partners. Okay, now I blew up this little tiny thing here. I wanted to see what it was. And when I blew it up, it turned out it was an archangel of some kind inside the 666 Mobius here, this frame. And it fit right in there identically. Okay, so I don't know if CBN is communicating with someone or they just picked a bad picture there. But you can see this lots of other places. Here's a book called The Treasury of Witchcraft. They are communicating with someone. They've got this little knot here tied around the devil's tail with the same symbol. Okay. Now, the New King James demotes the deity of the Lord Jesus Christ all over the place. Luke chapter 13, they don't call him Lord anymore. They're simply calling him Sir. Okay? Matthew 18:26, it says, and worshipped him, saying, Lord. They take the worship out, and they just simply say before him, saying, Master. So they're not worshipping him, and they're not saying Lord anymore. Okay? And all of the references to the Jesus Christ that I noticed or noted on there are... Now, I'm putting this one in just as a note of interest. I found it interesting, and it doesn't relate at all. But as a part of this royal arch of masonry, they put their hand in their chest like this. Now, remember Napoleon did this? Okay, Napoleon's motto was, to destroy, you must replace. Okay, now, someone cannot get in the pulpit on Sunday morning with a red cape and a tail and say, I hate the Bible, let's throw it out. But he can simply go in there in clerical garb with a New King James. He can simply replace it, and it's gone, and not a word was ever said. Okay, it reminds me of Napoleon. Now, this is a picture of Karl Marx. Why is Karl Marx doing this? Does he have an itch? I suspect there's something going on there. Okay, now, Marx and Lenin were very influenced by something called Hegel's dialectical materialism. Dialectical simply means we take one extreme and another extreme. And we make everyone sick of the extremes, and they pick the middle. For instance, communism, very extreme on one end. Democracy, some would say, Marx would, very extreme on the other end. What you land up with is international socialism, which is where we are moving to today. Okay? Now, this is what they're doing with the Bibles. They will create these horrible, terrible, inclusive Bibles, the New Revised Standard, some of these extreme ones. And they'll look at those and they'll say, bad, bad, you know. And then the King James, they'll pretend that it's archaic. And then they'll try to find something like the New King James or the NIV that's right in the middle. They're simply using Hegel's dialectical technique. Now, I just had to put this in there. You've all seen this before. But just to add to that other point that I've made, we have Anne Besant of the Theosophical Society doing a very similar hand motion with our friend Pat Robertson. And I have no idea why they were doing that, but maybe someone can tell me. But I thought it was very, very interesting. Okay, now, as far as using that logo is concerned, someone would say, well, that's a symbol for the Trinity. Remember we started out saying that the Bible is our final authority in all matters of faith and practice? And so we'll look at the Bible and see, what does it say about logos or pictures of the Trinity? In Acts 17:29, it says, we ought not to think the Godhead, that being the Trinity, is like anything graven by art or man's device. And so the Bible tells us no little pictures of the Trinity, kids. And in art, you have naturalistic art, you have stylized art, which would be that serpent that we saw, and you have abstract art, which would be the logo on the New King James. So it's another form of art there. The Bible tells us not to do that. But the New King James did something interesting. They put a picture on the front of the Trinity, or their so-called Trinity, but they omitted the Trinity in the Bible, the words. They omitted the Godhead in that very verse, Acts 17. And so we are moving from a word-based culture to an image-based culture. You can see this happening with young people, unable to read the Bible, but popping in a Jesus video. So we have pictures of Jesus, but didn't he say he was the Word? The Word made flesh. Okay. In Revelation, he's called the Word of God. In fact, he identifies him so much with that Word that he calls himself the Alpha and the Omega. That's the A to Z. All right? And so the Roman Catholic system was able to hold medieval Europe in its clutches for 1,000 years doing two things. And those things are happening to us today. Number one, they moved from a word-based culture to an image-based culture. Take the Bibles away from people. Put pictures on the walls. So that's a warning to you. The second warning is they said that only the Latin language scholars could work with the Bible. The common man couldn't understand the Bible. And you'll hear that on the radio today so often. They'll say, well, in the Greek it says this, or in the Greek it's that, or the Hebrew. And you get to the point where you think, well, I don't really have the Bible, or they'll correct the Word of God. You lose your confidence in the Word of God, so you don't read it during the week, and then you have to go to this intermediary person who's going to tell you what it really means. Okay, so those are two things that were used during the Middle Ages to control the masses, and I believe there are two things that are moving into the church today to try to gain control of us once more. Now, I want to talk about what that royal arch was. Remember we said royal arch? Okay, this is the symbol that you can see inside here, but this was Hitler's logo. I don't know if you remember seeing pictures in World War II of that standard, and then the people had this on top of the standard. Well, when you look at a Led Zeppelin album, you will see that logo that Hitler had with the 666 inside, and you also see the New King James logo. Why would Led Zeppelin, the inventors of heavy metal rock group, the group that bought Aleister Crowley's mansion in England, why would they put so-called symbols for the Trinity? Well, obviously they aren't symbols for the Trinity, because the Bible says don't have symbols. They are symbols for the unholy Trinity. I don't know if you can see this, the thing that's spinning around up there, but that's the Tamoti, the Shinto symbol for the revolutions of the universe. So that's going on there. But I'm showing you this to tell you that Led Zeppelin has two things out there that are very interesting that will tie all this together for you. Led Zeppelin has an album called The Presence, capital P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E, okay? And in that album, you know, obviously they're exalting the worship of Satan and the worship of Lucifer, and in all satanic and Luciferian literature, the devil is called the Presence, capital P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E. Now, I have found that moving into the Bible versions, where the name of God or whatever is being changed from a person, for instance, in the New King James, to Presence. Now, the New Revised Standard is the very worst Bible doing this. They do it half a dozen places. They're starting to take the name the Presence. Okay, now taking your names for Dee Dee from Led Zeppelin is probably not a good idea. But let's talk about who the Presence is, and we're going to see who the Royal Arch is. All right?
Gail Ripplinger there, talking about what she found researching her book, New Age Bible Versions. And she's speaking about Rupert Murdoch's new international translation of the Bible, shockingly less accurate than the King James Version from the 17th century and found in most Anglican churches. That's all for this week. Dialects, Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to this week's guests, Robin Gray, the Three Acres and a Cow Show Man, Della Reynolds, and also Angela Balassi, and Dave Bazanko, the studio engineer. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.